this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silly Cast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, November 22nd, 2009, and this is show number 234. So I think it's safe to say we're getting into the holiday season, and I'm just guessing that you're kind of like me, you're the kind of people who might shop at Amazon. Let's face it, we'd rather be buying online than talking to real people in stores, right? Okay, maybe everyone's getting that way these days, but nerds and geeks were afraid of them all from the very beginning. If you're going to do your holiday shopping at Amazon, please consider clicking through the Amazon link at podfeet.com. If you do, anything you buy once you get into Amazon will provide a small percentage back to help fund the show. Many of you have already done this, and I thank you for it. I never know who does it. I just get little bits of money coming in, so that's a lot of fun. It's not a lot, but if enough people do it, it starts to add up and helps pay the bills. I really appreciate the support. On the Mac ReviewCast this week at MacReviewCast.com, I did an in-depth review of VMware Fusion 3. That's software that allows you to run Linux or Windows on your Macintosh. I'm not going to repeat what I said there, but I gave it a very enthusiastic two thumbs up. After the review aired, Bob DeGrand wrote in about a spectacular deal running right now at Amazon. Basically, you buy the old version 2 for $19 and you get a free upgrade to VMware Fusion 3. Version 3 out of the box is $70 normally, so this is an outstanding deal. I put a link in the show notes to the deal, of course, using my Amazon affiliate link. You do have to do a $10 rebate thingy to get this low price, but even if you forget to do the rebate, you still get version 3 for $29 instead of $70. If you think there's even the remotest chance you'd like to try out Linux or run Windows 7 on your Mac, I'd suggest grabbing this deal. And no, they're not an advertiser. I just really like this software. In the chat room, Dan Eckmeyer is saying that VMware Fusion is also accessible with VoiceOver, so that might be a reason to pick it over Parallels for you. Well, it finally happened. Something wonderful. Something we've wanted to see happen for so very long. Yes, one of the Belgians finally sent me some Belgian chocolates. Well, okay, technically it wasn't one of the Belgians, it was Gazmaz from the UK. Now, this took some specific maneuvering. Here's his email explaining how the Belgian chocolates ended up in Los Angeles. They were bought in Mechelen in Belgium, and he attached a picture of the shop, took a taxi drive from Mechelen to Brussels MIDI station, Eurostar through Belgium and France to the St. Pancras station in London, underground journey to Paddington station, then a four-hour train trip to Liskeard in Cornwall in the UK, then a car trip home to Northampton, taken to Rugby where I work, handed to Hetty, my boss, where she took them to Manchester for a plane ride to Nashville where she forwarded them on to yourself. Hope you're enjoying them, Gaz. Now, seriously, that is dedication. These chocolates have been on a long journey, and they taste fantastic. I've been very stingy on who I share them with. Steve and Margaret were lucky enough to make the cut, but I didn't even consider taking them to work to share. Why is it that in the U.S. we come out with things like Hershey's chocolate, which is about as interesting as a wax sample, and Europe can create these dreamy, creamy delights? Anyway, I'm saving them, and I'm going to enjoy every bite. Thanks, Gazmaz. Michelle, also known as Country Signs, that's CNTRY Signs, in Twitter, sent in a review that helps her manage her time in Facebook. Let's listen in.
Hey, Allison. Michelle in New York. Okay, first the problem. I play way too many of those time management games on Facebook. But I really can't manage my time well enough to remember to go back to them to feed my fish or harvest my crops, etc. I know I can use iCal to create a reminder, but that takes so long to enter an event. So I found a solution. A free widget from gravityapps.com called simply Reminder. You type in how many, and then use the drop-down to choose from minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, even an exact time. I then put in which game to go back to and hit Enter. Automatically, a reminder will pop up when the time comes. The app automatically creates a new iCal calendar called Reminders, so it won't mix with the rest of your events. This way, if you sync with MobileMe or your iPhone, you can leave out the reminder to harvest your crops, but keep your grandma's birthday. You can even change the alarm that plays. It's the perfect time saver so I can waste more time playing. Oh, I guess I should say working. Really, I should be working. Take care, Allison. Enjoy.
Well, Michelle, this is the cutest little application. I downloaded it, put in a reminder for 1 minute later, and it showed me what time it will be when the alarm will go off. So it didn't say like 1 minute from now. It said 2:38 p.m. because I did it at 2:37 p.m. I popped open BusyCal, and just like they promise, it put the reminder in my calendar in a category called Reminder. Talk about doing one thing and doing one thing well. Now I just have to remember to set the reminders. Well, thanks for sending this in, Michelle. You should do more reviews like this. By the way, Michelle did that review with her iPod Touch using a Philips iMic and iTalk Pro. She didn't think the quality was great, but I thought it was just fine. Anyway, you can download the application Reminder at gravityapps.com. Have you bought a big screen TV lately? Or maybe a new AV receiver? And then you went into a big box store to buy the HDMI cable you forgot to get? And then you get up off the floor from giggling insanely because you thought the sales guy was kidding when he told you the price? I just saw the price of a 9-foot cable was $30 on sale at Best Buy this week. Say maybe you wanted to hook up a DVI monitor to your new MacBook, and then Apple told you that teeny little adapter cable was $25. Well, I have a solution for you. It's a site called monoprice.com. I've mentioned it before, and maybe you've heard of it, but these guys have amazingly low prices and don't even rip you off on shipping. I've bought HDMI cables there for under $10 that are absolutely perfect. I wanted to remind people because as we're buying all those things through my Amazon affiliate link, we're probably going to need some HDMI cables or other kind of cables or mounts for your new big screen TV. Let me give you a perfect example. Don't tell Kyle, but I bought him a new Dell LCD for Christmas that has a DisplayPort connector. That's great since the MacBook he has a DisplayPort too. But it's a mini DisplayPort, so it's that teeny tiny little one. So I knew I could buy a DisplayPort cable and then an adapter from Apple for a king's ransom, but I went over to MonoPrice instead. I got a little tangled up trying to decide should I get the regular DisplayPort cable plus like an adapter for it to go to the mini DisplayPort, or maybe they had a mini DisplayPort to big DisplayPort cable. So I was kind of confused, so I was looking around trying to decide which one to get, and then I saw the Chat Live button. So instead of spending my time trying to figure it out on my own, I clicked the button. In about 10 seconds, my new friend Mark came up on the line. He instantly showed me the link to a mini to big DisplayPort cable for $4.15. I'm serious. I'm not kidding. $4.15. Shipping was $1.73. I'm serious. Great site, great products, incredibly low prices, and fantastic customer service. What more can you ask? Check them out for all your cable needs and look out for all the other things they have. Like I said, I wish I'd known they sold those big TV wall mounts. Go to monoprice.com. And no, that wasn't a paid ad either. But maybe I should ask them about advertising. That would be so easy. All I'd have to do is read off the ad that was on the top of the page each week. Anyway, check it out at monoprice.com. It's time for another great review from Evan.
Hi, Allison and No Silly Cast listeners. It's Evan from Colorado coming at you with another review of a great iPhone app. This week's app is Ping by Gary Fung. Let's start with a potential problem. If you are like me, the $69 a month is enough to pay for your monthly iPhone bill, and even if you get the basic texting plan for $5 a month, you only get 200 text messages, which you burn through pretty quickly. This app is also great if you have an iPod Touch but want to send text-based messages to your friends and family. Basically, what Ping is a replacement for your SMS service from your cell provider. The interface is very similar to the Messages app that comes with your iPhone, but the catch is you can only send messages from Ping to other people who are using Ping. As of now, this limits you to talking with only your friends who have iPhones. I believe I heard somewhere there's a BlackBerry client as well, but I have no proof of this. When you launch Ping for the first time, it asks you to pick a Ping name. Assuming someone else does not pick the same name as you, you just type it and hit go, and you're all set. If you have picked the same name as someone else, you'll be asked to pick a different name. Also, the first time you launch Ping, you'll be asked if you want to allow or deny push notifications. If this is turned on, you get a pop-up alerting you of a new message, no matter what you're doing on your iPhone, even if the app is not open. After registering your Ping name, you are put into the main screen. In the upper right, there is a new message button. Hit that, and you are prompted to enter your friend's Ping name. Once you do, you just enter your message in the message field and hit send. That's it. After you've entered a friend's name, it will remember them and keep track of your conversations, just like in the default SMS app. In the lower left, there is a settings button. In there, there is the option to unregister your ping name in case you want to register a new name. There is also the option to turn sounds on and off and vibration on and off. From the main screen, there's also an envelope icon in the lower right. If you tap that, you are thrown into a new email message with the to field blank. You enter your friend's email address in the to field. And in the body of the message, it enters a link to download the Ping app from the iTunes store, along with a description of the app. It also tells the recipient what your Ping name is so they can ping you. That's about it. Ping is a very simple SMS replacement for your iPhone or iPod Touch. I've not had a single problem with it, and it seems very reliable and stable for me. As long as your friends are on Ping, the only reason I can see to use the standard SMS messaging and not Ping is because I can't seem to find any way to send MMSs or multimedia message with things like photos or videos. Ping is available in the App Store for 99 cents, and I've given Allison the iTunes link, which I'm sure she'll put in her show notes. To find out more about what I do, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/vanmo92.
Thanks, Evan. This sounds like something I could use because I'm too cheap to pay for more than 200 text messages. First, I thought it was kind of dumb, this Ping thing, because you can only text to other people on Ping, but all you have to really do is get the people that you text with a lot to get on Ping, and the rest of your friends, more occasional texters, can live in the 200 text message plan. So, for example, let's say Kyle and I text a lot, which we do, because he's a boy and he doesn't talk out loud. He's already on an iPhone, so if I could just relieve the pressure on my text plan by moving him to Ping, this would be a great way to solve my text overage problems for only $1. Especially since we authorize each other to each other's accounts, I'd only have to buy the application once. That would be made up in pretty much the first month or two, or first month of when I'd of my overages. I did a little bit of research, and it turns out people refer to Ping for the iPhone to be the equivalent to BlackBerry Messenger on the BlackBerry. It also allows you to message directly between BlackBerries without invoking text or SMS messages. Ping brings that same capability to the iPhone, but neither of these applications crosses the boundaries between phone manufacturers. So there is no Ping for the BlackBerry, there's no BlackBerry Messenger for the iPhone. I did find out something else fun about Ping. It works internationally. So Bart and I could ping for free across the world. I'm just sure Bart's dying for yet another way for me to send him messages like, what's that WordPress file again that holds that title information for my blog? Help me. He can't wait, I'm sure. Thanks, Evan. Great review as always. Greg of Blue Mango, the folks who make Screen Steps, sent me an email asking me to tell you about a special sale they're going to be running next week with a little bit of a twist. It's going to be during the Thanksgiving week, and here's the details. He says, last month we had our biggest sales month ever. Hey, wait a minute, guys. I told you guys not to buy it because I said I want to have constant contact and ability to get to these guys. So I don't want all you people buying this. Anyway, he says, so yeah, the biggest sales month ever. And last week we had our biggest single sales day ever. That was in the week I told you not to buy it. So what's the matter with you people? Anyway, he says, so thank you to everyone for their support. And to generate more sales, we're having a Thanksgiving week sale. But this isn't your standard sale. It goes stale over time. Get it? So Monday and Tuesday, it's fresh. You get 40% off all Blue Mango products. Wednesday, it's like day-old bread. You only get 30% off. Thursday, why are you shopping anyways? You should be eating turkey. It's 20% off. And Friday, it's stale. It's only 10% off. The sale will begin Monday and isn't combinable with any other offers. The percentage off can be applied to ScreenSteps Standard, ScreenSteps Pro, or the first 3 months of a ScreenSteps Live account. So if you signed up for a solo account at $19 a month, you'd only pay $11.40 a month for the first 3 months. This applies to any plan. All you need to do to take advantage of the sale is to use the coupon code THANKS in all capital letters. So now for Monday through Wednesday, that's a better deal than the Nocilla discount, my name all spelled backwards in all capital letters, but my coupon is only good on the desktop software. So if you're in the market for a ScreenSteps Live account, Thursday and Friday are still good deals. But what the heck, buy on Monday, you'll get a better deal altogether. Check this all out at ScreenSteps.com. Back in March of last year, I did a full-up review of Camtasia Studio for Windows and the then newly announced ScreenFlow from the Mac. both of which are video screencast applications. Just recently, the folks at Telestream.net released ScreenFlow 2, and I couldn't wait to get my hands on it to see how this product is advanced. I went back and reread my review from last year so I could remember how much I liked it and what room for improvement I might have seen. The very top of my list of things I wanted improved was that they didn't let you see visually the audio track. I used the visuals on audio quite a bit to figure out where to cut a clip, like if the doorbell rang or I sneezed or something like that, so not being able to see the audio was a big issue for me. I was also disappointed with the lack of good callouts, like what was then available on Camtasia Studio for Windows at the time. I did point out that Camtasia Studio for Windows was $300 and ScreenFlow for the Mac was only $100, so overall I gave ScreenFlow a B+ at the time. Let's see how it fares this time. The very first thing I checked was whether I could see the audio track, and to my delight, it was immediately visible. While that's good, it actually didn't tell me very much but that I could really work with because the waveform is so short vertically that unless I yelled into the mic, I couldn't really see the variations very well. So technically they did as I asked, but it wasn't terribly useful for me for editing. What they did add that's terrific is the ability to split an audio track out from a video track. Here's the problem that solves. Let's say you go through 10 minutes of screen recording and then realize you were talking into the wrong microphone. No worries, split the audio out, delete it, and then do an audio-only recording, this time on the right microphone, while watching your newly made video track and just drop it right in. You can use it for fixing a tiny little mistake, too. I can picture of a lot of reasons I would use this. They've added several new tools to the audio menu, too. You can control the volume, set up ducking. That's, say, like to bring the music volume down when you're talking, then bring it back up when you're done. You can add several special effects, which are mostly annoying. Like, for example, you can make it sound like you're in a big, echoey cathedral. I cannot quite see how that would enhance your viewer's experience or learning, so don't use that. Another feature I thought was missing from ScreenFlow was the ability to add text callouts to the videos created. ScreenFlow 2 does add this capability, but even better, they added what I really wanted, which is a button that records your keystrokes and modifiers on keystrokes, and they show that on the screen automatically. Let's say I click Command-C to copy. On Camtasia Studio for Windows, I would create a text callout and type in that command and adjust it on screen to show my viewers what I was doing. With ScreenFlow 2, it comes up automatically if I ask it to. Excellent feature and very well implemented. In that same menu, you can have it record the sound of your clicks, which sounded like a good idea at first, but it's awful. Three words. Do not do it. Oh, don't do it. That's three words. Anyway, one complaint I had with ScreenFlow was that you couldn't change the height of the tracks area to see all of them. So let's say you had four tracks going, you couldn't see them all, you'd have to scroll up and down, but sometimes you want to see how they're lining up with respect to each other. Now in ScreenFlow 2, you can adjust the height of that area. So far, they're betting 1,000 on fixing what bugged me. Should I claim I designed ScreenFlow 2 like those Windows commercials with those people who say, "It was my idea"? At this point of my usual poking around, I found that they had a tutorial complete with a tutorial video recording so you could follow along and do what they said step by step. I loved it. I love learning that way. I learned a ton about how to use the software, but it was too short. It ended. I wanted to keep going. And, you know, for documentation to be so good that I wanted to keep reading and playing along, it must have been fantastic. In desperation, I started scanning all of the key mapping options. This was cool because I figured if they had a keystroke for something, then it must be something useful and fun to do. I found out how to jump to the beginning or end of a clip with a keystroke, jump to a marker, put in a marker, all done with keystrokes. One of the keystrokes showed you how to define out and in points. This made a selection of my tracks all turn blue. I have no idea what else it did. I did a search of the help file for in-out points, and it did not reveal the mystery of what these things are for. I did learn how to jump to the next in-out point with a keystroke, though, so I had that going for me. I really like how ScreenFlow allows you to zoom in on the cursor, highlight the area, make the cursor really big for easy viewing, even blur the edges of the highlighted area. And once I watched the tutorial, I got a good handle on how to control it. It's a really nice way to make things clear to your viewing audience and draw their attention to a menu or a pull-down. Camtasia allows you to zoom the entire window up to show the area you're highlighting, which I think looks a little bit better than the way ScreenFlow does it. Instead of a circular area where your cursor is, you have a rectangular area highlighted. And since menus are usually rectangular, this looks a little more natural to me. I think ScreenFlow is slightly easier to control in putting it in, so these callouts might be a bit easier to do than they are over in Camtasia, but the overall result I think is a little better in Camtasia. Telestream has built in the ability to do some odd things with your video. You can rotate it to the right or left, sort of like putting it in perspective, or rotate it about the axis coming out of the screen so you'd have to tilt your head to watch it. I can't think for the life of me why they put this feature in. I remember in Camtasia, in my review for Camtasia for Mac, I found some tools there to do goofy things to the video that also seems like they put them in because they could, not because they should, or because anyone should ever use them to help convey information in a screencast. ScreenFlow does include some transitions between video clips that could jazz things up without irritating your viewers, like rotating the picture on screen. They have a whole slew of different transitions. Adding transitions is done a bit unconventionally, but I think it works. You drag your second clip so the beginning of it overlaps the end of the first clip. That creates a transition symbol where they overlap. If you click on the little gear on that overlap symbol, you can choose from a variety of transitions to get the effect you want. The less time they overlap, the faster the transition will take place. As always with tools like this, be cautious so you don't just irritate the daylights out of your viewers. As my mom always says, do ye all things in moderation. I was able to find a few typos in the help files. Like during the video tutorial, it tells you to add a 3D plane transition between two clips. But the command isn't called 3D plane. It's actually just called plane. Took me a while to find it because of that, but, you know, I got there eventually. They also said to insert an additional recording during the tutorial with Command-Shift-2, but the actual keystroke is Command-Shift-R. I can just picture what happened here. The people writing the documentation were doing it at the same time. These other folks are finishing up all the code. They're trying to finish at the same time. So it's easy to see how your documentation could get out of sync. That wasn't bad. It was just a couple of places, but I thought they might want to know, so I threw it in the review. They probably should go all the way through it just to make sure it's correct. Hey, if they did the documentation in screen steps, it would be easy to edit. There's a ton of small improvements to ScreenFlow that I did play with, like how you can stretch a clip and change its speed. Again, one of those things you should use with caution because it changes the pitch if it's an audio track. It should work fine on video only. Maybe you want to give yourself a little more time to describe a video track if you're adding audio after the fact. That could be really handy. They also made modification of clips easier by adding a contextual menu, so if you right-click on a track, you get all your menu choices. Once you're done messing with the clip, you can also lock it now so it doesn't get boogered accidentally. One thing that I'll continue to gripe about with all of these modern video screencast applications like ScreenFlow and Camtasia for Mac is that they make you record the entire screen and then crop or resize it after the fact. I would really like to record a defined area on my screen, say 1024 by 768, and maybe have them draw a box that I have to make sure I have to stay inside to make sure what I'm doing is on screen in the video. These giant high-resolution screens now will create files that, when resized for normal viewing, will have teeny tiny little text. I think I'll have to get used to recording at a lower resolution or something like that. And what if I crop it to some weird dimension like 642 by 784? What will that look like on players like the iPod Touch? Don't give me all that freedom. Make me stay in a box where I belong. You know, this does sound a little bit reminiscent of the issues I had mentally with programs like Pixelmator because it wouldn't let me crop to a standard print size like 4x6. It was just this freeform crop, even though I hadn't printed a photo in 2 years when Pixelmator came out. Maybe I have to learn to let go. I don't know. Bottom line is that the folks at Telestream have fixed everything I wanted them to fix with this upgrade, and they've added some enhancements I didn't even think of. So ScreenFlow moves up from its B+ rating to a full-on A. ScreenFlow is not cheap. It's $100, which is the same price as Camtasia for Mac, though, so it's on par. And it's nothing like the $300 you pay for something like Camtasia Studios on Windows. You can get an upgrade to version 2 of ScreenFlow if you already own version 1 for only $30. Check out ScreenFlow at telestream.net. It's been great fun watching research assistant Niraj and Honda Bob getting to know each other. It started with Honda Bob helping Niraj with his car, but now that Niraj has rebuilt Bob's website in WordPress, it's been even more fun. Bob is a geek through and through, and he's really enjoying putting more and more great content up on his website through at hdabob.com now that it's easy and beautiful. On this site, you can learn about each of the components of your car, troubleshoot problems, and read fantastic travel stories about Bob's adventures over the years if you go to his travel stories section. My favorite story is the one about how the Bureau of Consumer Affairs investigated his business practices. Read that story, and you'll get a flavor for why Bob is so successful as measured by the loyalty of his customers, like me. If you live in the LA or Orange County areas and you have a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's time for one of my favorite times of the week. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchats from BartB.ie. How are you today, Bart?
I'm a bit cranky. I think this whole country's cranky. It's mostly underwater, and I mean that in the worst possible way.
Not financially, but liquidy?
Oh, no, we're financially. We've been financially underwater all year. That's the news.
So it's raining more than cats and dogs?
Yeah, like giant big wolfhounds or something. Cork is our second city, and it was underwater yesterday. It was really sad to see, because you have this beautiful harbour front with these beautiful, typically Irish, multicolored houses in like luminous yellow and green, and you know that postcardy look. And there's water up to the windowsill.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh.
It's impossible to get to Galway at the moment because the road is blocked in two places. Train services are disrupted all over the place. The country's in bits. And what's worse is there's a massive storm on the way tonight where they're expecting winds of up to Beaufort scale number 11. Do you guys use that?
I don't think Beaufort we do. Scale thing? But if it goes to 11, that sounds really bad.
Well, it goes to 12. 12 is hurricane.
Ah.
Yeah, so 11 is still pretty serious.
Batten down the hatches, huh?
Pretty much. We're a bit inland here, so we probably won't get 11. We might get 9 or 10. But, anytime you hear them go above 8, it's like, that's not good. 8 is a gale. 9 is an extreme gale. 10 is a storm. 11 is an extreme storm. And 12 is hurricane.
Oh, yikes. That's not what they need.
No, definitely not.
Well, it's a big week for Belgium. What is it with the Belgians? You guys are taking over the world.
Well, the European Union anyway. And,
tell them what happened.
Yeah. Well, okay, the European Union's funny, right? Because it's not a country. So, like, the United States of America is a country. So you have a president who has lots of power.
Right.
Whereas the European Union is not a country. So they have, like, three bits. They have the European Commission, which is all public servants. They have the European Parliament, who we elect. And then they have something called the Council of Ministers, which is basically the Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of every country. And the Council of Ministers has decided that to be more efficient, they need to have a face. He represents all of them.
Ah, okay.
Which they're calling the President of the Council.
Oh, okay. That sounds like a big deal.
They're also making a foreign minister. So there's only two posts in this cabinet of this not country, which is the President of the Council and the Foreign Minister of the Council. The Foreign Minister is British, but the President is the Belgian Prime Minister.
Wow. Now, does he get 51% of the vote, or she?
Well, it's voted on by the heads of state. It's not voted on by the people.
Okay, but I mean, when a discussion comes up and a decision gets to be made, does the president get to make the decision or anything?
No. Europe is bureaucracy in the extreme. We have something called qualified majority voting. It's not a simple majority because then the small countries would always lose.
Okay.
So the small countries get more of a weight than the big countries. Well, no, the big countries get a little more of a weight, but the small countries still get more power than they would have if you just counted them by their size.
Okay.
What's
the president do then?
Well, there's never been one before, so I guess we're about to find out. But the idea is that they'll all get together in a meeting and the president will sort of be the public face whenever they need to deal with the rest of the world. So if they need to send someone over to go and talk to the Israelis or if they need to send someone over to go talk to the Americans, I presume they'll send him.
So he or she gets to be on TV then?
Exactly. Yeah, because normally no one has a clue what Europe is at because it's all bureaucracy and stuff. So now it'll have a face. Now, as it happens, it's a very stuffy face because if there's one thing this chap is famous for, he's a hardworking politician. He's not interesting. He's not exciting. He's not young. Usually wears grey. He has grey hair. He's quite small. He's not an exciting face. But he managed to form a government in Belgium, which makes him eminently qualified to do anything. Anyone who can make a government in Belgium is a genius.
Oh.
Which also means we have a slight problem now, is that if he sods off to Europe, we need to make another one.
So, well, but it doesn't sound like there's too much to this job. Sounds like he could just, you know, do the photo tour and stuff.
I have actually no. He'll be dealing with all the other heads of state to figure to come to agreement on stuff. He will be a very busy man.
Ooh.
Getting the French and the British and the Germans all to agree on stuff. That's all he'll be doing.
Yeah, that does sound like a thankless job. Well. Yeah. Yeah, like I said, I think the Belgians are taking over the world. But hey, let's get on with the show.
Okie dokie.
I think we're going to start out with a redux thing here, right?
Yeah, eat your greens, I think is the phrase. What is it you usually say to me? Something like that.
Eat your vegetables first.
Yeah. So last week we talked about the whole why you want to use a separate browser for banking, which is all correct and above board. And we talked about the fact that it's a bit of a pain in the backside to have to always close everything and open up a fresh browser session. So we said a good way around that is to use Fluid.
Can I break in real quick before we get to the part where we are going to talk about is I finally just sat down and did it. And, you know, we made it sound really hard. You download Fluid, you type in, you double click it, you type in the URL you want to go to, you name it and decide what icon you want it to look like and you're done. And it's an application. That's all you do. So I now have one that's called Bank. You know, that's all I had to do. It's awesome.
Yeah. So that's great. Except if your main browser is Safari.
Uh-oh.
Because unfortunately, I don't know what version of Safari this happened in, but this certainly wasn't the case historically, but it is now. And I'm not a big Safari user, so I really don't know when it changed. But Safari and all WebKit stuff on a machine now share one cookie folder between all the different WebKit browsers.
Rendering this solution completely worthless?
For this particular purpose, yes. It's still a really good solution for having a separate app for your different web things. So for having Gmail as an app, it's still perfect. But it's not perfect if you want to isolate cookies, which is exactly what we want to do.
Now, you need to give credit to the person who figured this out here.
Oh, absolutely. We have, well, let me see. His username is not his name, but he signed off Tony, so I think it's okay to say Tony.
App Sharman or something. Or AP Sharman or App Sharman.
Yeah, that's why I'm going with Tony.
Okay, there you go.
But anyway, Tony kindly replied and said, look, I did a bit of testing, and I'm afraid to say what you said is no longer true. There is a shared folder in your library folder in your account called Cookies, and that contains all of your cookies for anything that uses WebKit. Which I'm assuming Apple thought was a good idea, but I think is a stupid idea. But there we go. So I did a test of my own just to verify, and he's absolutely positively correct. So Fluid is not the answer here. But, as luck would have it, earlier in the week I got an at reply on Twitter from a different listener who's a Windows user rather than a Mac user. And he was looking for a Windows solution, and he was asking, well, what about this thing called Prism from Mozilla Labs? So as soon as we had a problem with the Fluid thing, I thought to myself, Mozilla's cross-platform. I wonder, is this Prism thing cross-platform? So I did my experimentations, and the answer is yes. So Prism is like Fluid, only sort of in a pre-alpha stage.
Okay. Pre-alpha.
It has no polish.
So wait.
It works. It's not buggy.
But we're talking about doing our banking on something pre-alpha?
Right. Well, no, it's not really pre-alpha because it's the Firefox engine.
Okay.
But it's sort of the... What's the opposite of the deluxe model?
The cheesy model.
The hyper-mega uber-economy model.
Okay.
So the idea is exactly the same. You have a separate standalone app which uses the Firefox engine to render web pages, but it isolates it. And this one actually also isolates your cookies.
Well, wait a minute.
So
if we're going to use Firefox, though, why wouldn't we use Fluid with Firefox, just not use it with Safari?
We could do that, but I'm saying if Safari is your main browser and you still want to have a standalone one.
Okay.
I guess
we're going to be able to use something from Mozilla to solve the Safari problem?
Well, yeah, because this thing actually gives an app that is a browser that is 100% isolated.
Okay, so maybe I should let you keep explaining.
The other nice thing is that this is cross-platform because it's from Firefox, so it's available for Windows, Linux, and Mac, so everyone gets to play along with this one.
Ooh.
So it's called Prism. It's at Mozilla Labs. The link is in the show notes, I believe.
Yes.
I intended to put it there.
MozillaLabs.com/Prism.
Okay. And so the same idea, you run Prism, and it will ask you for a URL and a name. It doesn't ask you for an icon. You can change the icon, but it takes a little more effort. And then it creates an app, and it sticks it into your applications folder. Unlike Fluid, it doesn't let you choose where it goes. It sort of gives you two options. You can either have it on your desktop, or you can have it in your applications folder, and that's your only choices.
Okay.
But fair enough. So you do that, and then it creates an app in your applications folder, probably. And what you can do if you really want to change the icon is you can click on it, go Command-I, or right-click, and go down to Info, I think it is, or Get Info, or something like that. Command-I, anyway. And then if you select the icon, you'll see it go sort of like a blue hazel come around it. And then go into a photo app or something and select and copy an image, and then copy and paste, and it will actually paste that into the icon.
Okay. But for normal people...
So I did that with my bank logo.
Okay.
Well, no, it's actually very simple, because we have the logo sitting there anyway that we would have used in Fluid.
Right.
So just double-click the PNG, opens it up in Preview.
Oh, right.
Control, Command-A, Command-C, click Command-V.
One of the things Bart and I were talking about was the idea of actually talking about shortcuts, and I'm so with you. That's exactly the sequence of steps. I like that. Great.
So that works. And then you have an app that is completely isolated and your cookies are contained. Now, the downside is I have a feeling this is more polished on non-OS X platforms. Because in OS X, it gets its own icon, it goes into the dock correctly. When you hover over the dock, you see the name you gave it. But in the menu bar, it's called Prism instead of My Banking or whatever you called it.
Okay.
So it's as if their Mac OS X integration is not really with it yet.
Mm.
But it works. It does work, and it's using the Firefox engine, which is a good, solid, sturdy engine. So it works, but it's not. You don't get the impression that you're using a highly polished app. You get the impression that you're using a proof of concept that proves the point very well. But someone needs to go around with a bit of lick of paint here, a little bow here.
No, I was just looking at it. It says you can choose an icon from there. Does it? It doesn't work?
I didn't see it choosing. I didn't see a way to do it on OS X. Now, I have to admit, it may just be user error on my part.
Yeah, the last, when you first open it up, there's three panes. There's web application, so you give it the URL and give it a name and check some boxes. And then there's whether you want to create a shortcut on the desktop or applications mm-hmm. folder. The third thing is icon.
Oh, well, look at that. Aren't I blind?
Well, you got there anyway.
I got there anyway, so my way works too.
So this is a Firefox browser, or it isn't, or...
It uses Firefox's engine, but it does not share the cookies with your other Firefox profile.
So if you don't have Firefox on your machine, you can still do this?
It's a pretty big download, so I get the impression it has Firefox inside it, but I could be wrong. Oh, you may have to install Firefox as well.
Hmm.
Okay, you seem to have a different version to me, because mine says URL, name, and gives me some checkboxes, and that's it.
Oh. Well, how come you downloaded the bad one?
Mine's only
30 megabytes, too.
Only is an interesting term for 30 megabytes.
Well, okay, but I mean, that's not... That can't have Firefox in it. Firefox?
It not, I don't know. How big is Firefox?
And I'm running 1.0 beta 2, so it's not pre-alpha. It's got a B in it.
Yeah, I didn't mean it was literally pre-alpha. I just sort of meant in terms of its...
Well,
Firefox is 50 megs.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it works. So it in the time we've been talking, I did it again.
There we go. So you have your banking in that one you can use.
Yep, and it's got my pretty little icon, too.
Now, anyone whose main browser is Firefox, you can use Fluid, because Fluid is just going to be writing cookies into Safari, which you never use. So, meh. Anywho.
All right.
So thank you very much to Tony for doing some good research there.
Yeah, he went back and forth with you a bunch of times. It's all in the comments in the show notes from last week. So yeah, that was great.
Yeah, no, it was very good. So thank you very much, Tony. Security Light.
Security Light. All right.
So I have some words
my favorite
that
part of the
they're
week.
Not going to like.
Oh.
Zero-day exploit, Windows 7.
Mm-hmm.
and server 2008, but I don't think that affects many people listening.
So Windows 7's been out for almost 2 weeks? This is zero-day exploit.
It's a little longer, but yeah. It's not very long, but yes. As 0 days go, one could argue this one isn't catastrophic.
Okay.
Because it does not allow our favorite phrase, arbitrary code execution, but it does cause the first half of that phrase, which is unexpected application termination, or in Microsoft terminology, denial of service. Or in my terminology, BSOD.
Blue screen of death?
Blue screen of death, that's exactly what it does. So basically, this is network-based. It's in the SMB protocol, which is Windows File Sharing. And what would happen is you would be working away on your Windows 7 machine, someone on the network would send a maliciously crafted Samba packet at you, and your machine would lock up and go blue screen of death.
Great.
So they could have great fun around the office. You annoy someone and they B-side you. This takes us really back in time. Many, many, many years ago, in the early versions of Windows, there was something called the ping of death. It was a mistake in the Microsoft TCP/IP stack, and if you sent a certain type of ping packet at it, it would crash the machine instantly, BSOD.
And you guys did that to each other, didn't you?
We did that to each other in the lab, in the IT labs as university undergrads, yes. And it resulted in one lad getting stuck in a headlock at the top of the class. He did it to sort of the, you know, the rugby player in the class. He was a 6 foot something guy. And he was the nerdy quiet guy in the back. And the demonstrator, who was the, you know, the supervisor in the lab, felt that the guy, the big tall guy, had a point and he didn't intervene. So that was the last time that the ping of death was used in our class.
Oh, I like geek viciousness. That's good stuff. But it turns out most...
But it's so typical, you know, the geek, you know, the other guy can't outsmart the geek in terms of, you know, geekiness. So he just stands up and grabs him in a headlock.
I like it.
Anywho, protecting yourself because this is security light.
So is there an update for it?
There is no update. It's still a 0 day. It's unaddressed.
So it's actually like a couple of day exploit now?
Oh, no, a 0 day means that the exploit comes out before a patch.
Right. Okay.
And that's still true.
So you said now, protect yourself. How do you protect yourself?
Well, you could turn off Windows file sharing, which is probably a big overreaction. The nice thing is that if you're at home behind your NAT router, no one from the outside can attack you.
Oh, okay.
So your only danger is from your kids or your visitors.
Or if you're at work, but then the danger is from your coworkers.
From your coworkers, yes.
The bigger your organization, the higher the probability of there being morons.
Yes, unless your organization is segmented so that your Windows sort of, so that you're on lots of separate little networks.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, if you're at home, your NAT router should protect you.
Good.
Unless you've explicitly put in port forwarding of the Windows ports, in which case you really should undo that. And you should undo that anyway, because it is probably one of the most dangerous things you can possibly do.
Why would anybody have opened those?
That way you could use file sharing to connect back to your house, along with the rest of the world.
Oh.
So it's handy for you, but kind of unwise.
So things like go to my PC, they don't open those, do they? Or back to my Mac or anything like that?
They're all VPN-esque solutions that basically let you tunnel into your home network and then it's as if you're there.
Oh, okay.
So that's how it should be done. That's the right way to do these things.
Cool.
So if you're in a corporate environment or whatever where you're on the big bad internet for real, your sysadmin should have firewalled off these two ports, which are 139 and 445. If they haven't, they should be fired. Regardless of this Windows 7 flaw, those ports should always be blocked. So in theory, you're only at risk from your family and your coworkers. And they can't steal your data, they can just annoy you a lot.
Okay. All right, so as zero-day exploits go, not the worst one we've ever seen, but kind of disappointing to see it that soon.
It is disappointing to see it that soon. It's disappointing that it has such a severe effect, because it's not nice when you get a blue screen of death in the middle of something you're doing.
Right. All right, what's our main topic for today?
Our main topic is one that we have had on the back burner for about a year and a half.
I've been begging you to do this one.
I keep putting it off because I always like to have one in the tank, but I just didn't get a chance this week to come up with anything else, so we're emptying the tank today.
But it's a good one. It's not the bottom of the dregs of the tank.
Oh, no, absolutely not. This is one I've been dying to do. I kept on putting it off until I'd be finished, but I've come to the conclusion this is a long-term project.
Okay.
So I'm just going to have to live with that. And people are going to have to wait to see if for themselves what I've been up to. But we can talk about it for sure.
Oh, you're just going to tease them then?
Well, I might. We'll see. I might. I might release a sort of a half of one, but no, I'll explain as we go why it's going to take me a while, because it's a big project. And being me, I've doubled it.
All right, quit teasing. What's the project?
Okay, so let's do a little setup then of how I started on this. A year and a half ago, must have been a year. Whenever I was in Belgium, that would be 2 years ago. Anyway, I was in Belgium. I was out on a cycle near my hometown. And it was a beautiful day, and there was this like lump of bricks with a small, small, small little plaque on it. So I stopped the bike and had a look and had a read, and it said that this is all that remains of the bridge for the railway across the river here. And this used to be the quicker line between Antwerp and Brussels. And I sort of looked around, and I was like, there is nothing whatsoever here apart from this very small square of bricks. What on earth happened to this railway? So I sort of, wow, that's kind of interesting, and forgot about it. And then when I was home in Ireland, I went, I took a photograph of it, and I went, I must geotag that. So I fired up Google Earth to get the coordinates, and I realized that on Google Earth, it wasn't nothing. There was this perfectly clear line of green showing the exact route the railroad used to take, because the land that a railroad is on never kind of gets reused, so it had just become overgrown. And so there was this perfect line of trees gently sloping its way through the countryside.
Oh.
And that unmistakable way that railroads do, mostly straight with big gentle curves and never, ever, ever a sharp corner, because trains don't do that.
So finding the shape is easy.
So it actually stands out amazingly well. When you look down from above in Google Earth, you know, the field boundaries, all those little squares of various sort of contorted shapes. But this perfect sort of big sweeping curve through it is really obvious from on high. Very obvious. And so I began to trace it, and I got it the whole way back to where it meets the current railroad. I thought, okay, that's interesting. So that's where it broke off. And I followed it on and followed it on, and then I noticed what becomes the other most common thing you do with old railroads. They either become overgrown, or because they have really solid foundations and they're straight and they're level, they are fantastic bases to use as roads.
Okay.
So this railway track became the main motorway between Brussels and Antwerp. So the line of trees suddenly comes into a motorway
that sort
of gently curves into it. And the rest of the way into Antwerp, it's a motorway. And at that point, I kind of lost track of it because it ceases to be obvious. But then I did a bit more reading, and I found a website which lists every railroad Belgium has ever had, and it lists all the stations on it. And so the stations give you places. And so I lost the railway line as it entered into Antwerp, but the names of the places showed me that actually it still is there as a street.
Oh,
so it's
cool.
A series of streets which also have that long, sweeping curve. And all the other streets are almost grid-like, and then you have this sweeping curve coming through, ending at what is now a very large building that I believe is used for the courts, but what was a very large train station.
Okay.
So that sort of got me a bit of the bug. So I had the website, and I saw how easy it was on Google Earth to follow that one line, which is line 25A, if anyone's keeping count. So all the lines were there. Because Belgium nationalizes rail network very early, so they were all under state control, all under control of the one company, so they all got a nice number from 1 to, I think it's 176. Now, they're not all lines are not there, and some of them are doubled up. So you have lines 25A and 25B, for example, or 25 and 25A. But they all belong to one company, so they all have logical numbering, and this website had them all. So I started at line 1 and made my way through. And a lot of them were very easy to find, but not all the stations are easy to find. So I actually have all of the lines in Belgium mapped, just the lines. There's one I have an educated guess of, and there's one I just can't find at all. And I think it's just because it's in an area where it's just been totally changed. So there's actually nothing left to find, which is annoying. But out of the few hundred, out of the 150 odd, I have 148 of them that I'm sure of, one of them that I'm pretty sure of, and one of them I just can't find.
So when you say you have them mapped, what does that mean? Are you saying you found them on the map and they already show on Google Map, or you're creating a map of them?
Okay, so I'm using Google Earth to create an overlay in Google Earth of these lines. So basically you pick the line tool and you just click, 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 click the whole way along the line.
Oh.
And then you save it. And then you can drop in the stations by using pins, and they actually have different graphics you can use, so you can actually make sensible pins. I had little ones that look like a train. figured that was good at a different station. And then tunnel entrances, I also have one that technically I think is meant to be the symbol for an underground, but it looks like a train and a tunnel, so I figured that'll do for tunnels. And then junctions are little arrows. And then, of course, they're all labeled. But the stations are much harder to find because a lot of them, when they're gone, I mean, a lot of them were just a platform and a ticket office that was made of a little wooden shed and they closed 100 years ago. So shock and or horror, there ain't nothing to see there now. But, so I did one run through the whole of Belgium and I got pretty much everything and I was pretty happy with it. But then I came across, in the time I've been working on this, which took me about a year, someone on the Belgian version, well, it's the Dutch version of Wikipedia. It's wikipedia.nl, which is sort of half of Belgium and the Netherlands, really, because they speak the same language. And Wikipedia is by language rather than by country. So someone on wikipedia.nl had started to put up track diagrams for the Belgian rail lines. These are basically, they're kind of interesting. They're not maps, absolutely not maps. They represent the line as a straight line, always.
Even though it curves? Then,
no curves. The line is just straight. It's a representation of what's happening rather than a map. So every station is marked along that line with its milepost. So it says Antwerp Central is zero, and then it might say that Antwerp Berchem is 1.4k, and then I'll tell you that the junction to line 50 is at 1.6k, and then I'll say there's a tunnel that's 400 meters long, and then it'll say that the next station is at 4.5k, and then there might be another line coming in. So you see a straight line with dots on it for stations. If it crosses a river, it'll draw the river on it and give you maybe, maybe not a distance. And then it'll show you junctions. But the line that it's describing is always straight from top to bottom, and you read it from the top down.
So what do you do with all of that?
You can use the measuring tool in Google Earth to measure a curve.
Okay.
So you put your starting point on the station where the line starts, and you click along so that your measuring line follows the curve of the track. And whenever you get to a milepost that's supposed to be a station, you can drop in an icon because that's where the station was. Even if you can't see it anymore, that's where it was.
Okay.
And so you follow along. And so given that information, I can actually finish the picture.
So when you're done, what is this?
When I am done, I will have a complete map, which is color-coded to show whether the line is current or past, of every train line and every station there has ever been in Belgium. And it will be overlaid on Google Earth, so you can do all the Google Earth zooming in and stuff, because it will just be in Google Earth. It will show up as if it was a road or whatever in the real Google Earth.
Now, you know what you really need to do? You need to send the vast fleet of Belgians we have listening to go take pictures of every one of these places for you. Wouldn't that be awesome?
It would be very awesome, but I don't think you understand the magnitude of the job. Belgium was the first country in Europe, on the continent of Europe. The British were the very first. Stevenson made the first commercial railway line. But the first on the continent of Europe to follow were the Belgians, and it was a line from Brussels that eventually made it to Antwerp. First it was Brussels to Mechelen, and then it was extended from there to Antwerp. And it actually passes through my hometown. So the line where I've been taking my train pictures for years is actually the oldest railway line on the entire continent of Europe.
Wow.
Which I didn't know at the time. I know that now.
So what kind of year are we talking about?
I knew you'd ask me that, and I should have checked. It's early 1800s. It's like 1830s, that kind of time. I think, now I'm guessing, I think it's something like 1838 or 1840. It's very long ago.
Wow.
But it's really given me an opportunity to really get to know Google Earth. Really get to know Google Earth. So, you know, it starts off fairly easy. Okay, I'm going to do this. And very soon you end up with a giant big mess that's unmanageable. So then you have to start using Google Earth's folder structures, which is kind of nice because you can uncheck a whole folder at once.
You and your anal folder structures are happy now.
In my anal folder, yes. So I was able to then group them by line. But when you actually zoom out to the country as a whole, the icons always stay the same size no matter how much you're zoomed in or out. And there are literally hundreds upon hundreds of stations. In Belgium, you know, as you zoom out to the whole of Belgium, all you see is a glob of the station icons. You can't see the country anymore. So then I realized that my system was wrong. So I had been doing a folder per line. But what I really needed to do was have one folder for each line which had the outlines and another folder which had the stations.
Okay, so if you're looking at one line, you can turn the stations on and off and not have the stations come on for all the other lines?
Or because you put, so you have a folder called line outlines, and in each one you have a folder for each line. And then you have another folder called stations, and in each one you have all the stations. So you can then at the global level turn off the stations and see the rail network in Belgium as just the lines. And they won't be cluttered. And that's perfect. But then I wanted more. Of course I did. So then I broke out my stations into two sets. So you have two types of station when you think about it. You have ones where it's just one railway line and the station is just on that line. And then you have the important stations, which is where one or more railway lines meet. So they're different to a regular station.
I see.
So I split those out and I put those into what I call junction stations. So now you can enable the outlines and the junction stations. That's actually meaningful information because you would then have the start and end point of every line, but it's not so much that the map becomes unreadable.
So when you're done or when you're halfway done or 90% done, do you share this with other people? Does it become an option in Google Earth if they think it's cool enough or what happens?
Well, I can export it as a KMZ file, which means anyone can then open it in Google Earth. So my plan is to GPL it and stick it on the web and hopefully have other people correct it. So basically, I've many colors. So I have dark, very dark blue means that this line is in a part where the Google Earth image is so good I can see the sleepers, and this line is 100% correct. Not a little less dark blue means, you know, the Google Earth photo here is good enough that I can see where it's going, but I can't really see where the sleepers are. I can't really see that exactly, so that's blue. And then I've sort of a purpley color for where I'm not quite sure. And in the harbor of Antwerp, it gets insanely confusing as to which line is actually which. And you end up making educated guesses, so I put those in purple.
What's a sleeper?
It's the transverse thing that runs, so you have the track, and then you have these either wood or concrete blocks between the lines.
You mean railroad ties?
Okay, well, they're in Europe, they're called sleepers.
You're talking about the perpendicular things that hold up the track?
Yeah.
Oh.
We call so you have the ballast ties underneath, which is gravel, basically.
Uh-huh.
And then the sleepers on the ballast, and then the track on the sleepers.
Wow. I wonder why they call them sleepers. That seems so strange.
It is a funny word. Blame the British. They invented it. And the whole idea of railways. Yes. So that's. And
sorry,
then I also
didn't mean to derail you there.
Oh, you've been waiting to use that one, haven't you?
For 17 minutes, yeah.
So then the past stuff, we then have green means I'm sure of it, yellow means I'm not sure of it, and orange means I've pretty much guessed at this.
I made
very,
this one
very
up.
Little orange. Yeah, really that one, there's two tracks that have orange on them. For the rest, it's pretty much all there. Then we have the other thing that I'm starting to read more and more about planned future lines, and I'm sort of wondering, oh, I wonder what that's going to link in. So as I find plans for future, I'm also putting them in white.
Hmm.
And there's actually a lot of building going on in Belgian railway network.
Maybe they should be dashed.
Can't do that.
Oh.
You have no choice of line style. You can make the line thinner or less thin. You can make it a different color, and you can make it more or less see-through.
Okay.
And they're the only controls you have. No dots, no dashes, nothing like that. I would have loved, actually, to have a dotted one.
Right. And dotted would be good for the ones you were making up, too.
Dotted, yeah, exactly. That'd be great, but unfortunately not. So I had to do it all with color. And then I've done the same with the stations. So the stations are different shades of blue if they're current and different shades of green or yellow if they are not current.
This sort of cries out for a collaborative solution, doesn't it? That to have more people looking at it who have different information?
Certainly. Absolutely.
And perhaps could actually traipse down to the through the marsh the over to the thing is and say, there it is.
Yeah, yeah. That certainly would be cool. So that's one of the reasons I'm very keen that when I have my first fully together version of it, to stick it up online. Because there's going to be yellows, which means things I'm not completely sure of, and there's going to be purples, which are things I'm not completely sure of. So the ultimate aim is that in the future, it will all be certain.
All right. And how long do you think it's going to be before you can share it to the point where they can help you?
Depends on how distracted I get. Because you see, I've been mentioning Belgium all along, which is good. But I then distracted myself and started doing Ireland as well.
You really need to put this out there so other people can help. So collectively,
know,
you can be not
I know,
distracted.
But no, me being me, of course, I started reading little bits of history here and there about the Irish Rail Network. And me being me and being a huge fan of Google Earth, I, of course, went, oh, I wonder if there's any trace of that left. Oh, look, there it is. And so off I was again. So in Ireland, it was much lesser. In Ireland, it's actually way more confusing because Ireland did not nationalize its rail network for a very long time. And then when it did, there were two countries because Northern Ireland had already split off at that stage. So there's two national grids and the old railway companies do not respect the border at all. And they also had a terrible habit of merging with each other. So just one station, if I were to pick at random, a station on the line from Dublin to Belfast, the chances are that it was built in the early 1800s by one company, perhaps the Ulster Railway, would have then been merged in... Actually, okay, I'll pick Port... I'll pick Dungannon, just because I was working on that yesterday. So Dungannon would have been built by a small company that just built one line from Portadown to Dungannon to Omagh. So it was the Portadown, Dungannon and Omagh Railway Company. Short and snappy title. And they were then merged with the Ulster Railway, which is a short and snappy title. But they were trying to avoid being taken over by the Great Northern, but they didn't succeed. So the Great Northern took them over anyway. So that one line has now belonged to three. And then the Great Northern was nationalised to be the Ulster Transport Authority, which was renamed to the Ulster Railway Authority. Hang on, to the Ulster Transport Railway, which was then... Actually, they then closed it down, unfortunately. If they hadn't have closed it down, it would have then been renamed to Northern Irish Railways. So that one station would have, if it hadn't have been closed down. I've lost count there, but you get the idea. Very complex.
All right.
So so the other thing I do want to mention is that there's a lot of stuff changing. And a new feature on the latest version of Google Earth is a slider for time. So on the previous Google Earths, you've been able to zoom in and out, which is great.
Right.
And in some cities, they had 3D models of buildings, which is very cool. But that's not really as done in Europe, unfortunately, because I guess their vans haven't been around or something. And you have Street View in American stuff, but that hasn't really been done around here either. But now you have a new dimension. There's a slider you can bring up to change the time. And if it's a place that Google Earth have multiple images of, you can slide forward and backward in time. And this is really important. In my case, it's been really important in three places in Belgium. The first is what I guess you could describe as Belgium's version of Detroit. Once booming technological area, in this case it was coal mines and heavy ironwork. And so, you know, coal mines and these things, huge big buildings, massive railway infrastructure because it all got shipped out by trains. So you would have had huge giant freight yards. And when you move that slider, and nowadays they're almost all gone. There's almost nothing left of that rail infrastructure around the Charleroi area. But if you take that slider back even a decade, because it doesn't go back very far, unfortunately, in that part of Belgium, depends on what pictures they have, you can just watch these buildings spring up again, because you're going backwards in time, and you can watch them go from having no roof to having a roof again. And then you slide the slider the other way, and it's like, building, very bad-looking building, blank ground to apartment blocks.
So does that mean you can set the stuff that you're doing by date and time or anything of when it was built or to have that come in and out?
Not.
Okay.
It does mean that when I'm trying to find, it was very difficult around Charleroi to find all the lines. So it does mean that when I'm trying to find where these industrial railroads went, I just slide the slider back as far as it'll go and the chances are they're still there.
Okay.
Or if not, the ruins of the buildings they went to are still there and so you can still find their outline.
I see.
But if you slide forward, you get apartment blocks. Which means that you can't see where the railway yards would have been.
Okay.
But just going back far enough to see the railway yards in ruins is enough for me to draw them in on the map.
Excellent, excellent.
And then in Brussels, we have the opposite, where they're doing massive new work, and you need to see what they're currently doing.
Okay, cool. Well, hey, before we close out, I convince you to take a screen snapshot of a little bit of it that looks cool so that people can see what you're talking about?
I tell you what.
Please.
I'll give you my current dump of what I have.
Okay.
Bearing in mind it's not complete, because I'm in the process of changing all the folders and stuff, so I can't give you a full Belgium, but I can give you a fair chunk. I'm up to line 125, I think.
Wow.
So I can put
that up.
But even
just a screenshot, you know, where people could see it.
Yeah, that's no fun. No, I'll stick up the KMZ file of where I am.
Oh, yay.
So you can see it, and... although I'm doing it in the number of the lines, which in theory should have no actual geographic meaning, they do seem to cluster. So there's like a hole or haven't been yet.
Well, who knows? You just don't know if some Belgian listening isn't just going to traipse out there and find some of these for you.
Yeah, absolutely. It'd be great. So I will stick that up and people can see what I'm talking about. It has, unfortunately, also the side effect that I now know of a lot of the bugs in Google Earth. And goodness me, are there bugs in Google Earth?
Well, maybe we better show. We might have to save that for another show, though, Bart.
Okay, I'll promise to be quick.
Okay, all right.
The first one is it crashes. So Command S constantly.
Yeah.
Always, always, always Command S. And the other one is you now, in this latest version, you can't rearrange folders.
Oh,
if you have
no.
a folder of folders, you can't put them in the right order. So at the moment, when I put up that KMZ file, they're going to be in a bizarre order. I'm hoping the bug is fixed and I'll rearrange them into, you know, the proper order. But they're broken down into lines 1 to 20, but inside there, they're just in a random order.
Okay.
Very annoying. But anyway, so they're just the two giant big bugs I found.
What a pain.
And that's it.
Well, this is fun. I've always wanted to know exactly what you're doing here. I had a vague idea, but this is pretty cool and a cool use of Google Earth. So we'll be looking forward to seeing how that works. I can't wait to download that and throw it up there. So the KMZ file, as you say, you just double-click that and it opens in Google Earth, right?
Yes, it'll show up under your temporary places, and then you'll see it. So you just move the globe around to Belgium and you'll see it, or you can just double-click on one of the lines and it'll spin the globe around for you. And if you want to keep it, you just drag and drop it out of your temporary places into your My Places.
Oh, okay, cool.
And then you'll have it. Now, if a new version comes out, delete it, open the KMZ file and drag it up instead.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Bart. This is pretty cool. We're on schedule for next week?
I will probably be at my parents' next week, unfortunately.
We might be able to work around it with since I'm off all week.
Oh, in that case, we probably will. Maybe. So we will make something happen.
All right. Sounds good. Talk to you later, Bart.
Okay. Talk to you soon. And until then, happy computing.
Well, I guess I'm going to wrap this up with my wishes for a peaceful, safe, and calorie-filled Thanksgiving for my American friends. And maybe you and other parts of the world can enjoy a cranberry or some stuffing, even though it's not your holiday. Any excuse to eat, right? Well, be sure to keep up all the great emails by sending them to allison@podfeet.com. And be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.